part of a coherent whole in any case. Okay. So my goal for this talk is to try to give you some sense, okay, of what this 100 and however many page paper says, and the papers before it, about the proof of the ending lamination conjecture. As Dick alluded to earlier, really this boils down to a proof of a kind of model theorem, or the existence of some sort of geometric model for hyperbolic manifolds of a certain type. Okay, so, and this is what I'm going to talk about is joint work with Canary and Minsky. And my pointer is not working anymore. Okay, so we'll just have to do this. Okay, so I want to describe a model manifold. So let's recall what the model theorem says. So if we have a complete hyperbolic free manifold, homeomorphic to surface cross R, and the end invariant is given by nu, okay, then there is a combinatorial model three-manifold. Okay, this is a three-manifold with some piecewise nice metric, and it depends only on the invariant nu, and we have, so out of this combinatorial construction, one obtains a three-manifold and a Bielefschitz diffeomorphism on the pieces. So it's built up from blocks from the model to the original hyperbolic manifold. Okay, so why does this say anything about the ending lamination conjecture? It's nice to have models for things. But what does a Bielefschitz model have to do with ELC? So any two manifolds, M and M prime, any two hyperbolic free manifolds, M and M prime, with the same corresponding invariant are Bielefschitz to a common model manifold. That's what the theorem says. Okay, so you have sort of a model in the middle, imagine, and then these maps to M and another map to M prime. Well, those maps taken together give a Bielefschitz diffeomorphism between the hyperbolic manifolds themselves. Okay, so you can trace back via the model to M prime, if you like. Okay? And then this induces, by the extension to the sphere at infinity, a quasi-conformal conjugacy of the actions of the corresponding Kleinian groups. Now, what Sullivan's rigidity theorem says is that if you have a quasi-conformal conjugacy of finitely generated Kleinian groups, and you have the end invariant data recorded. Okay, so we might be in a situation where both of the ends are these simply degenerate ends, and there are no cusps in the picture. So in this case, the limit set is the entire Riemann sphere, and Sullivan's theorem says that any quasi-conformal conjugacy of Kleinian groups limit set the entire sphere is homotopic to, I mean, is conformal, and therefore the original Bielefschitz diffeomorphism is homotopic to an isometry. Now, more generally, you might have, say, one end that is geometrically finite and one end that's infinite, and the conformal structure at infinity, which is the end invariant in the case of the geometrically finite example, also can serve as input to Sullivan's theorem. So basically, Sullivan's theorem allows you to say, just knowing the end invariants, if you've got a QC conjugacy, it's conformal, and therefore the manifolds are isometric. Now, this is in the S cross R case, at least in this discussion. So what do you do in general? Well, in general, you've got some compact core and then a collection of ends, and you pass to covers corresponding to the ends. And after a little bit of fussing around, the model theorem allows you to develop a model for the end in question, at least some neighborhood of the end in question. Okay, so you have a model of geometry out beyond some finite point away from the compact core, some point, some surface at finite distance. So then, let me just draw a little caricature. So this is a picture that's oft repeated so far. So imagine we have a compact core. When we pass to the covers corresponding to the end, let me just cheat and imagine that M has incompressible boundary, so all these surfaces inject on pi 1. Then each cover corresponding to the end is just a product of the surface with an interval itself. And the end invariant for this end lifts to the end invariant for the cover. So we develop models for each of these ends, and if you've got a Bielefschitz conjugacy between manifold M and manifold M prime, if you have a map on the ends that's Bielefschitz, well, what's left over is just this compact piece. You can extend that Bielefschitz map on the ends across the compact piece and get a Bielefschitz model. Get a Bielefschitz conjugacy between M and M prime in general. Okay, so this is enough to prove the ending lamination conjecture. But as Dick said, it's a lot more. I mean, this is a very explicit understanding of what the geometry of the three manifold looks like. So that's what I'm going to try to develop over the course of this talk. So let me begin with a sort of more tractable case that was resolved by Minsky back in 95. Okay, and this is the case of the punctured torus. Well, what is the case of the punctured torus? Okay, so what we're doing is looking at a certain class of hyperbolic three manifolds that come from representations of the fundamental group of the one-holed torus, which is just the free group on two generators, but to make them behave like quasi-Fuchsian groups or Fuchsian groups more generally of closed surfaces, we just make the assumption that the commutator have parabolic image under the representation. So the boundary curve of the torus is forced to be parabolic in the discussion. Okay? So in this case, well, in the geometrically finite or quasi-Fuchsian setting, the end invariants are just hyperbolic structures on punctured tori. So the Teichmuller space of the punctured torus is just the upper half plane. So for such an invariant, our invariant lies in H2, but now when we allow these more general invariants, be they ending laminations, and we can unify that with the case where the structure is degenerated by pinching a curve to think of that as a special case of an ending lamination, if you like, where we've just pinched a single simple closed curve. Those are like rational points on the boundary of H2. And the ending laminations, the genuine ending laminations Dick described, are like the irrational points. Okay, so here, if our invariant lies in the rationals, it corresponds to just a simple closed curve of slope, the corresponding rational number, and our more general end invariants, the points in the irrationals, are like so-called laminations of slope nu, where nu is this irrational number. So the number of times you traverse in the longitudinal versus the meridional direction converges to this irrational number, the ratios. Okay, so those are our generalization. So I'm going to make a precise definition of what a lamination is in a moment, but this is the kind of picture. So whereas before we had a picture that represented the lift of a single simple closed curve on a surface, and they're nicely separated in H2, the geodesic laminations of a more general form have leaves, if you like, that sort of converge together in different directions, and the transverse structure, instead of just looking like a single, the intersection is a single point, can have much more complicated structure to that of, say, a cancer set in general. Okay. So the end invariants will be simple closed curves or laminations. Geodesic lamination on a hyperbolic surface, well, it's just a closed subset of the hyperbolic surface. It's foliated by infinite geodesics. Okay. So for geodesics, it can be extended infinitely in each direction. They might be simple closed curves as well. So there are a couple of straightforward cases. This surface has a hyperbolic structure. Of course, just a single closed geodesic is a geodesic lamination. Or you could have geodesics that wind in towards this single simple closed curve. Those are sort of the uninteresting geodesic laminations. And more generally, sorry, I thought I had a picture ready to go there. More generally, there might be no leaves, no geodesics in the lamination that are isolated on each side, meaning such that the transverse intersection with the intersection with a transverse arc is just a single point when the arc is sufficiently small. So these laminations sort of wind around the surface. Or, okay, so here's a picture that will be sort of a model for this particular simple case. So the fairy graph essentially consists of edges or bi-infinite geodesics in the hyperbolic plane joining pairs of points, rational points, whose corresponding curves on the torus have intersection number 1. Okay, so if you've never seen this picture, here it is. And the combinatorics of this triangulation encode completely what the geometric model for the hyperbolic 3-manifold in this space of punctured torus representations with the corresponding pair of end invariants should look like. So this green arc here is sort of supposed to represent what one does to construct the model, namely, given, say, a pair of rational points or irrational points, join them by a green hyperbolic geodesic so that you know the difference between green and black, and then observe the combinatorics of this triangulation, of this tessellation, as the green geodesic traverses them. So note what happens in this particular case. Well, as I'm moving along, I cut off a triangle to the left, and then I cut off a triangle to the right, cut off a triangle to the left, and I cut off a triangle to the right, and so on and so on, as I converge in this direction. And it's sort of, I think, a really nice geometric manifestation of the continued fraction expansion for the limit point of this green geodesic. So what one sees is some sequence, some number of left triangles and some number of right triangles. And if you normalize things correctly and record the number of lefts and then the number of rights and then the number of lefts and then the number of rights, those are precisely the continued fraction entries for the continued fraction expansion of the limit. Okay, so note in particular that if this green geodesic happens to land at a rational, that sequence of numbers stops at some point, and so that sequence of numbers is a rational continued fraction expansion. Okay, so how does this geodesic tell us anything about this model 3-manifold? Well, we can then sort of develop a recipe to build the model using that sequence of numbers, the continued fraction entries. So there's a standard block. This is literally, you can just take the room metric. So imagine you've got this block sitting in the room and just induce the appropriate metric from R3 on it as it sits here. Well, in the case of the punctured torus, imagine I've identified the B sides to the B side B to side B prime and side A to side A prime. what does that look like? If I don't touch these little grooves here, that's just a one-holed torus. The cross-section is just a one-holed torus. It's sort of like a one-holed torus cross-eye, but now I've cut these other grooves out of the top and the bottom, right? So what happens if I stack these blocks end-to-end? Well, then I've got this enormous bi-infinite one-holed torus cross-R with a bunch of slots cut out of it. So what are those slots? Well, if I took a given block and I cut it across the middle, one slot would look like a longitude on that one-holed torus, and the other slot would look like a meridian. And then as I continue up, I see pairs of curves on the one-holed torus that intersect once if I view them from a given halfway level surface here. Does that make sense? So another way, so to start off constructing a model in the one-holed torus case, so we'll see a picture that looks like this later. So imagine this is some kind of caricature of the block, just seen kind of from the side, but maybe from an angle or something. So I'm literally just gluing these blocks end to end. What does that mean? Well, the top faces of this block, what happens after I'm done identifying them, identifying opposite sides, the top face looks like a three-holed sphere. Okay? So I glue these three-holed spheres together, and I have a bi-infinite stack that looks like a sort of three-manifold Swiss cheese. So you've got a hole here and a hole here and a hole here, and each one of those holes has boundary a torus. So there's another, if you like topological visualization games, there's another way. The question is, can I draw the Borromean ring? There's another way to see this picture. No, that looks linked, doesn't it? Did I get it right? Yeah, I think so. I think that's correct. Is that the Borromean rings, anyone? Yes, I think so. Okay, so what one obtains, another way to think about this topological construction of stacking an infinite number of these blocks end to end, is to imagine one has S3 minus the Borromean rings, okay, and then choose one of the three components, doesn't matter which, and now take the infinite cyclic cover corresponding to this yellow component here. Now, believe it or not, there's a Seifert surface for this yellow component that winds through this picture. Sort of looks like something like that. That is a one-holed torus. And one of the components is isotopic to a meridian on that one-holed torus, and the other is isotopic to a longitude on that one-holed torus. So what is the infinite cyclic cover? You cut the picture along the yellow one-holed torus, and then you just unwind it. You just stack them end to end. And that's exactly the same picture. So here's a topological formulation of this model that one obtains by identifying opposite sides of this block and gluing them end to end. Well, that doesn't really look like S cross R yet. It looks like S cross R minus a bunch of solid tori. So we have to say what we're going to do to fill in the solid tori. Well, that's whenever you're filling in a solid torus in a three-manifold, that's a Dehn filling operation. Okay? So what is the Dehn filling that we need to do? So that basically means you select some curve on the torus and you proscribe that curve should correspond to a disk. You glue that disk in, and there's a unique way then to fill in the rest of the three-manifold with a ball along that. So once you cut a solid torus by a disk, there's just a ball left over. Now we're going to do this metrically in the land of hyperbolic geometry, and there's a theorem called the Dane filling theorem, which says that you can fill this in a nice metric way and get a hyperbolic manifold at least one cusp at a time. So, and as it happens, to get the model, the Dane filling parameters, the numbers that you use to fill in each cusp, are exactly the continued fraction expansion. So remember, we have this green geodesic in the hyperbolic plane. Normally, we think of a continued fraction expansion as a sort of one-directional infinite sequence of numbers. That encodes one irrational number. But if you've got a pair of them, a pair of irrational numbers, and you normalize things correctly so that the green arc goes through a sort of standard triangle in the tessellation, then you obtain a bi-infinite continued fraction expansion. So see, a bi-infinite sequence of integers. And that bi-infinite sequence of integers is exactly the recipe for how to Dane fill each of these solid tori to obtain a model. So the moral of the story is there's some combinatorial procedure where you start with a canonical picture just coming from this infinite cyclic cover or this infinite stack of blocks. There were no choices there. And now some sequence of numbers that come from the end invariants tell you how to metrically fill in and get a model manifold. The picture is sort of rendered to make it look like you're twisting because this one represents the 0-1 curve, say, on the torus, and the other one represents the 1-0 curve. So let me draw another picture, which is what a level in this. So I'm sort of, this curve represents the what's left over here with this groove after I've identified opposite sides. The slot on the top somehow looks like I've gouged out that an annulus in this running this way. The slot on the bottom looks like I've cut out an annulus that crosses it. So imagine if you like that there's some thickness to this punctured torus. So just cross it by a little interval, put the yellow band on the top and the gray band on the bottom, and dig a ditch. And these are the ditches. So when you glue those together, the two ditches form a solid torus, or what used to be the two ditches forms a solid torus. And that's what you're filling in with these coefficients. Another way to say this is just leave the metric as you see it, and then there's a prescribed metric on a solid torus corresponding to the rational number, corresponding to the filling coefficient. Use that metric to fill in the torus and go in each direction. Yes. Mm-hmm. Just A's. So essentially, Each one of those parameters prescribes for you a metric up to some Bi-Lipschitz fudge factor on a solid torus. Okay? If the parameter is really large, that metric actually starts to look more and more degenerate, like it's actually some kind of cusp. Okay? But the boundary of that tube is always controlled. It just looks like a nice bounded diameter torus. As the parameter tends to infinity, remember, that means you're sort of crossing more and more of these triangles as you move in. So you have a larger and larger, you have a really large entry in your continued fraction expansion. Well, in some sense, what that means is that the curve that you're supposed to fill in has to wind around the torus a lot before you fill it in. So it's very long. And when you fill it in, you have a very short core to the torus. Okay, so there's a little hyperbolic geometry of Z plus C subgroups lurking in the background here, but there is a recipe to do it, which is what I'm trying to get across here. Okay? All right, so unfortunately, this is a very simplistic example from the point of view of the general, from the higher genus case. Okay? So whereas in this example, because of the simplicity of this case, topologically, the tori of these that we're filling in has some kind of controlled diameter boundary. And as it happens, this need not be true in general. Okay, so these are called Margulis tubes. The components of the thin part where the injectivity radius is small in the manifold that do not correspond to cusps, where there is some core geodesic. So, well, I wasn't going to go through the proof. I was just going to tell you what it was. So I mean, well, I mean, you have to first. Okay, so what one has to do is to show that the, and this is a general feature, to show that when one sees these large entries in the continued fraction expansion, that they correspond to short curves in the hyperbolic manifold. Okay, so, and this, yes, that's right. Well, it comes from a lot of work. so it sort of, I mean, it comes from, so first knowing that the curves are short actually is some sort of, ends up being some kind of geometric limit argument. So you have to go from having one, nice bounded geometry slice of the manifold on one side to another nice bounded geometry slice of the manifold where the curves that occur with bounded length on each side are very twisted up with respect to one another. So, and whenever you have phenomena like this in the hyperbolic manifold, it corresponds to the homotopy between these two bounded geometry surfaces being very long. And so you have to figure out where it can be long, and as it happens, the only place that homotopy can be long is exactly along the annulus where the twisting is taking place. So, I mean, there's a large apparatus involving geometric limits and involving Thurston's uniform injectivity theorem, so we have to get our hands on these pleated surfaces. So if you'll let me proceed, I'll try to at least say where it comes from. Okay, so the problem that is presented in the more general setting when we get away from the punctured torus is something like the following. So in the punctured torus, imagine you almost have kind of a nice product of the punctured torus with the real line, and then these tubes marching up. These are like these slots that are getting filled in by some coefficient, A1, A2, A3. Well, in general, so in some sense, the reason these tubes are controlled just has to do with the fact that there isn't much more surface left after you cut out an annulus. So when you cut out an annulus on a punctured torus, all that's left is a three-holed sphere. The geometry of a three-holed sphere is essentially constant, right? So there's not much that can happen as you move from one side of a tube to another on the remaining surface. On a bigger surface, however, if you cut out an annulus, say here, there's moduli on either side. Okay, so you can, as one curve gets short, you can change one side or the other of this curve, well, essentially as much as you like. And as this as these changes are taking place, the curve is remaining short, so as it happens, the Margulis tubes that one sees in this context can develop strange geometry. Okay, so I have a slide, I think, coming up here. So first of all, let's go back to another easy case, when we have a mapping class, a self-mapping of a surface, that happens to have this property of being pseudo-Anosov, so that no isotopy class of simple closed curves ever returns to itself. It acts freely, if you like, on the isotopy classes of simple closed curves, well, then the mapping torus that one obtains is hyperbolic. Okay, so then one can pass to the cover corresponding to S, and one obtains a periodic manifold. So you just see one copy of the fundamental domain translated forward and backward. So this is somehow looks quasi-isometric to the real line. Okay. But in general, there's kind of non-uniform geometry that can take place. So this is another example in the genus 2 case, what I'm alluding to here. So remember, we had this Alforge bearish parameterization for quasi-Fuchsian groups, where once we fix a pair of Riemann surfaces, we know the manifold completely. Well, one thing we haven't really been saying so much about is that actually there are bounds in terms of closed curves on X and, say, Y, if there was a Y here, and their length in the hyperbolic tree manifold. This is a theorem of Baer's again. So it does say something about the geometry. Knowing the surface X and knowing the surface Y tells you at least some first level of information that if you have a bounded length loop on X, its length in the three manifold is also bounded by, say, twice its length on X. Okay, so that means if I start twisting up one side of a quasi-Fuchsian manifold by something or other, say a mapping class, I start to see geometric changes in terms of what that mapping class does. Okay, so if the mapping class is mixing up one side of the surface, well, that side of the manifold is going to get more complicated. So here, this is an example where if I take a diffeomorphism of the surface that corresponds to a simple just Dain twist about the alpha curve up here, followed by a Dain twist about beta, that's only going to mix up the right-hand side of the surface, if you like. The left-hand side of the surface, the punctured torus on the left-hand side, is left alone. So as I iterate that mapping class, I obtain a sequence of quasi-Fuchsian groups. Now, what happens is, because you have these bounds on the length of simple closed curves on each side in terms of these Riemann surfaces, the S cross R structure that you see in the hyperbolic manifold remains somewhat controlled on this left-hand side, this left-hand punctured torus. So literally, if I just paint a one-holed torus on the boundary, I can push it through the manifold from one side of the convex core to the other in not very much time. There's a bounded homotopy. But as I iterate this mapping class, the same cannot be said of the other side. It takes longer and longer for this other torus to go around. So what compensates for that? Well, what compensates for that is a sort of explosion of this Margulis tube. This thin part starts to get really enormous in the middle. It's forced to, because the times as I push surfaces through the manifold are sort of out of sync. Okay, and there are various ways to kind of characterize or say what this means. And if one lets n tend to infinity, one obtains kind of perverse geometric limits. So the limiting structure on the surface. What's going on here? I lost my. Okay, I was thinking. In fact, this amount of time it takes to get around here gets longer and longer, to where in the limit it never gets around at all. So the manifold has somehow degenerated in some way. And the point is, we're going to have to model that geometry somehow or other, and it's not going to come in some nice discrete form like this, okay? Because you can imagine this occurring all over a general surface. So what one has to do is introduce a notion of sort of generalized continued fractions. So we're not just going to have some kind of sequence of numbers, like a continued fraction expansion, but rather some sort of big set of numbers where each number corresponds to some topological subsurface of the original surface. And that will be an identifier for how complex that subsurface is in the hyperbolic manifold. So that's what I want to try to relate to you. So each essential subsurface of the whole surface inherits a kind of projection coefficient. And this projection coefficient is determined by these ending laminations, by the end invariants. And it measures somehow how complex the end invariants are with respect to that subsurface. Okay, so it goes via the geometry of the complex of curves, which Dick defined, and I'll say a little bit more about here. Okay, so we take all of these, take all of this kind of generalized continued fraction information, and we need a way to collate it, sort of organize it. And that takes the form of what's called a hierarchy. And a hierarchy is really just a set of geodesics in various curve complexes. Okay, so we have the curve complex that's associated to the surface. Well, every subsurface of the original surface has its own curve complex. Okay, and if that if a given subsurface T has one of these, has a number associated to it, one of these generalized continued fraction numbers that's large, then it will show up in this hierarchy. So it's a collection of geodesics in curve complexes of subsurfaces of S. So how does this work? It's important to know how it works because it's actually a direct combinatorial blueprint for what the model manifold is going to look like. Sort of you just do this combinatorial investigation, depends only on the end invariants nu here, and then from that combinatorial apparatus, the model just descends. Okay. So how does it work? So here's the complex of curves again. So the zero skeleton, the vertices are just the isotopy classes of essential simple closed curves on the surface. So one vertex for each one. And the k-simplices are spanned by families of k plus one simple closed curves, or isotopy classes thereof, with the property that their geometric intersection number, their pairwise geometric intersection number, is zero. So you can find representatives of them that don't intersect.
Computer's dying. Okay. Came back to life.
Okay, so here's a caricature of the of some simplices. So we have, well, various maximal simplices in the genus 2 case. So those are maximal number of curves that can be realized pairwise disjointly. So the purple, blue, and red curves form a simplex, a triangle. And the red, blue, and green curves also form a triangle. And then the green and brown curves are joined by an edge because they can be realized disjointly, but there's no edges joining the brown curve to any of the others because it intersects all of those. Okay. Okay, and then there's another case, which is when S is a one-hole torus or four-hole sphere. Well, any two simple closed curves on the one-hole torus intersect, so you have to take some sort of modification of that. You just require that you put in an edge if two curves intersect minimally. Okay, so here's three curves that, and in fact, it's worth mentioning that this is simply the Ferry graph again. So if we have two curves that intersect once, we put an edge between them. So that just corresponds again directly to the Ferry graph. Okay, and so it's a theorem of Mazur-Minsky that this curve complex as a metric space where you allow, we just assign each edge length 1 is negatively curved in the sense of Gromov. And the boundary is the candidate ending laminations in the Gromov boundary. Now, it's actually, because of the local infiniteness of this complex, it's somewhat subtle, but nevertheless, one can exhibit, given a pair of candidate end invariants, a pair of ending laminations at the boundary, one can exhibit a geodesic joining them. So a geodesic plowing through the curve complex that limits in the positive direction to nu plus, in the negative direction to nu minus. And then there's a sort of a thickening of this geodesic called a hierarchy. So let me describe how that goes, but then the basic point is that at the, so when you thickened it up all the way, so before we, you know, if you think about what a geodesic is in the curve complex, it's just a sequence of isotopy classes of curves such that as I move along, each one is disjoint from the previous one, right? So you sort of move along and you're sort of tracking along and the two neighbors of a given one intersect. And then as you thicken it up, you arrive at some sort of sequence of pants decompositions of the surface that are organized around this original sequence of curves. And those pants decompositions are related by simple moves. And a simple move essentially corresponds to taking, so you have a pants decomposition, you take one curve on it, and then you move an edge in the corresponding complex of curves of the subsurface in which it lies in the complements of the other. So it sits in a punctured torus in the complements of the other curves. You're allowed to move once in that punctured torus. That's an elementary move on pants decompositions, and it also corresponds to one of these blocks that we had in the punctured torus case. I don't know. Did I put one in here? I think so. Yeah, here we go. Okay, so here's the case of a five-hold sphere. I mean, sorry, a two-hold torus. Looking at it, calling it a five-hold sphere. So the here's an edge in the curve complex, a sequence of edges in the curve complex, a geodesic. So the blue curve is this alpha naught, and then I have alpha minus one is purple, alpha one is red. So what the hierarchy does is it tells you how to move from alpha minus one to alpha one in the complement of alpha zero. Okay, so this is the sort of thickening. Here I have just a geodesic in the curve complex. Now I'm going to add another geodesic in a smaller curve complex that traverses from alpha minus one to alpha one. Well, where do those things lie? They lie in the curve complex of S minus alpha zero. So that's the where the geodesic is going to lie. And this is what the picture looks like at the end of the day. So you have this so-called main geodesic with the alpha minus 1, alpha 0, and alpha 1. And now I get from alpha minus 1 to alpha 1 by starting with beta 1, okay? And now I find another curve that intersects that once. So the yellow circles here are meant to indicate what is appearing in the picture. So here you have the blue curve, the purple curve, and something that intersects the purple curve minimally in the complement of alpha zero. So now I move to that one. Now I do another elementary move. So these are the elementary moves on pants decompositions. And then I arrive at the alpha one curve. Now, what's the point from the point of view of the model? How does this give you a blueprint of the model? Well, each one of these moves precisely corresponds to a block in the punctured torus picture. And so if I imagine moving along and stacking up blocks as I go, then I have some hyperbolic, or I have some three-manifold that's built up from this procedure. Okay. So again, so what this does is it gives me a sequence of pants decompositions. And I can build a model from that sequence of pants decompositions. Now, how does this relate to this notion of continued fractions? Well, this is a little more delicate, but here's roughly the picture. Okay, so what's the question? You've got nu minus and nu plus, these end invariants. And I want to know what number, if any, they associate to a subsurface. Well, that's going to come from this notion of a subsurface projection. So literally what I do is I look at the subsurface And then I have this new plus, say, this lamination that's crossing the subsurface. So I want to find some kind of something in the curve complex of that. So I just do what's called subsurface projection. I project it into the curve. I project the green lamination into the curve complex. How do I do that? Well, I just do a surgery procedure that cuts the green lamination and collapses them. So what happened here? Well, when you take, what is a lamination? It's a bunch of geodesics winding around the surface. If I simply take the sequence of arcs that I get as the intersection of the leaves with the subsurface, okay, the subsurface has its boundary right here and here, well, there are only finitely many isotopy classes of arcs if I allow the endpoints to move within the boundary. Okay, that's sometimes called mod boundary, so isotopy mod boundary, in any given subsurface. So the lamination has, say, infinitely many leaves going through the subsurface, but when I cut them and I allow them to move with their endpoints in the boundary, I end up with finitely many isotopy classes. So that gives me some collection of arcs, finitely many. Now I take some kind of regular neighborhood of those arcs together with the boundary, and after making a couple of judicious choices that you show later don't matter, you end up with a simple closed curve in the subsurface. Okay? So what gives? Well, I started with a lamination, say nu plus, and I produced a simple closed curve in the subsurface. Well, I can also do the same thing with nu minus, and I get another simple closed curve in the subsurface. All right, so I've got these two end invariants. I get two simple closed curves in a fixed surface. I can then measure their distance in that subsurface. And that is the notion that I want of a continued fraction associated to a subsurface. What was secretly going on in the punctured torus case is that you were doing exactly this, but with respect to an annulus. Okay? So when you look at this bi-infinite continued fraction expansion for a pair of irrational numbers, little did you know that the number of rights that you see is the number of times some kind of projection of the lamination corresponding to one end and the projection of the lamination corresponding to the other end, how much they're twisted one with respect to the other in the annulus corresponding to the curve where all the triangles are hitting. So, you know, when you're going across these triangles, they all have a vertex in common. That vertex is some curve, was represented by some curve on the torus. The number, the continued fraction entry, is how many Dane twists I have to perform about that curve to move from the projection of one endpoint to the projection of the other endpoint, and so on and so on and so on. So this is just a generalization of that idea. Okay, so let me say more now. So we have this. The result is a projection. It was an ending lamination. And now, in this original picture, if Y was the one-hole torus bounded by alpha naught, then the statement is, and this is a hierarchy structure theorem, so this is due to Mazur and Minsky, that this curve alpha minus 1 actually is more or less, so up to distance bounded by something in terms of the genus, the projection of nu minus into that subsurface. And the curve alpha 1 is more or less a projection of nu plus. So in fact, as I move forward and backward along this main geodesic, all of these curves from the perspective of Y look exactly the same until they get to these neighbors of alpha naught. And then they change. So they don't change before, and they don't change after. They only change right as you move from alpha minus 1 to alpha 1. Okay, so here's how you see what the combinatorics corresponding to the end invariance is. You've got this, you know, potentially infinite list of subsurfaces. Well, it will in general be infinite, but potentially way more infinite than you want it to be. And you come up with some kind of almost ordered list of subsurfaces that occur that's just like the continued fraction expansion. Okay, so These projections control the structure of the hierarchy and thus the geometry. So let me increase the tangent vector here. Okay, so in particular, if I've got a given curve that shows up in the hierarchy, there's this number. In fact, you can think of it as a complex number associated to it, and it has two parts. The first is how much nu minus and nu plus are twisted about gamma. So this is just like the continued fraction entry in the punctured torus case. So I sort of look at these two laminations as they hit an annulus and record how twisted they are, one with respect to the other, the annulus corresponding to gamma. And then I have this funny sum, which is over all subsurfaces of S that contain gamma in their boundary. Okay? So this is, of course, some huge infinite list. And now the kappa makes the sum tractable. What kappa is I only record these numbers if they're greater than some integer kappa, where kappa depends only on the genus of the surface. So there's a threshold constant, kappa. Okay? So that's set in advance. I record these projection numbers if they're bigger than kappa, and then I associate that complex number, where this is just the usual I, to the curve gamma. And then this, as it happens, controls the length. Okay? So if this complex number has large modulus, first of all, the length of the curve in the hyperbolic three manifold is small. Okay, so that's the analog of the control of the length in the punctured torus case. So what this says is that there are two ways for a curve to get short in the hyperbolic three manifold. Either you can twist a lot about it. If you're looking at the two ends, say of a quasi-Fuchsian group, you can introduce lots of twists to one of the two Riemann surfaces, or somehow you can create a lot of topological complexity in an adjacent subsurface, so in a subsurface that contains the curve in its boundary, just like we did in this example. And you think of that as the complex part, the twisting as the real part, and then if either one of those is big, then you get a short curve gamma. It's actually sort of more true in the other direction, you see later. In fact, you get pretty good estimates on the complex length of a short curve, a curve you already know is short, in terms of this omega of gamma. So it's something like they're inversely related, as it turns out, in the complex setting. Okay, but this is enough to at least get the first stage here. So the combinatorics of the sequence give you these instructions. I already said all this. Okay, and once you know this fact that I just mentioned, then you can show that everything in the hierarchy, all of the curves that show up in this hierarchy, have some a priori length bound. So this is Minsky's a priori bounds theorem. Okay. And this is what you need to get going to produce just a Lipschitz model map. Okay. So, in fact, one needs to get rid of tubes on each side. So this should really be... Well, okay, so I haven't said what M sub nu is. So I haven't filled in any of these tori yet that we described. So you have a bunch of tori in general that are missing. So M sub nu is like S cross R minus a bunch of solid tori corresponding to curves on various levels. And you get a Lipschitz map of that object in the appropriate homotopy class into M. Okay. So you form this kind of combinatorial epsilon thin part by filling in the tubes that are supposed to be big enough. Okay. So that aren't too short. So the combinatorial epsilon thick part. Okay, and then Minsky proves that this model map can be made tube preserving on this combinatorial epsilon thick part. Okay, so if you So the idea is that if you know that a curve is supposed to be short from the combinatorics, right, based on this estimate earlier, then it really is short in the hyperbolic manifold. So there's this nice tube that's nice and embedded in the manifold, in the hyperbolic manifold. So when you form this combinatorial thing, you have a good chance that by leaving those corresponding tubes out of it, that you can actually get a relative embedding or an embedding of pairs, a nice homeomorphism of pairs of the model with those tubes cut out to the thick part of the actual hyperbolic manifold. Okay, and in fact, you know that large coefficient corresponds, if and only if, to small curves at the end. This is the so-called short curve theorem. Okay, so the question then is, how do we get this promoted to be some sort of Bielefschitz map? So how do we actually finish it off? Well, it's tricky. So there's all of these tools coming from the theory of pleated surfaces and geometric limits that, well, what you'd really like to try to do is take all of these blocks that you use to construct the manifold and straighten them out in some way, make their boundaries nice and embedded. I mean, a priori, you just have some Lipschitz map. You know it sends the tube boundaries to the tube boundaries. And you know it's Lipschitz. Okay, but that doesn't mean that there couldn't be bad non-injectivity or that it's not, that it doesn't sort of double back in some way. It's hard to know. So what we have to do is kind of straighten it out piece by piece. And really what we do is we sort of understand each piece locally, get it to be a nice Bielefschitz homeomorphism on these local pieces called regions without having a good global picture, and then use a topological argument at the end of the day, a degree argument, to say that if you've got something that's nice on various regions, like this blue one here, that in fact, using the just degree argument, that this gives you a global homeomorphism that happens to be by Lipschitz. So let me just flash through that, because it's... Okay, so you have this combinatorial epsilon thick part. That's the model. It's S cross R with tubes missing for all the curves that should be short. Okay? And we decompose this into these collections of blocks called regions. They're comprised of boundedly many blocks. There's an a priori bound on the number of blocks in a given region. And the purpose of the regions is that by allowing ourselves to take sort of more than one, but a bounded number of blocks, we can ensure that the boundaries of these regions embed. So the boundary of each region embeds. We don't know that all the different regions have pairwise embedded boundary, but we can control the boundary of a given region. So this is some connected collection of blocks. Okay? And we can preserve the fact that the map is Lipschitz. Okay? And it's a Bielefschitz embedding on the boundary. All right? And now, there's a geometric limit argument which says, well, if you've got a Lipschitz map on a region and it's bi-Lipschitz on the boundary, well, you imagine could in some sequence, some horrifying sequence of examples, the best bi-Lipschitz constant be tending to infinity. Well, the Lipschitzness allows you to pass to a geometric limit. So sort of control the geometry in a sequence just using the fact that the map is Lipschitz, and the fact that it's bi-Lipschitz on the boundary means that you can extract a limiting embedding of the boundary into some three-manifold. Okay, so you take this geometric limit. This is sort of this general principle of the worse things get, the better they are. Okay, so you imagine you've got some sequence of things getting worse and worse. You take a limit. The limit exists. Okay, so you can push the limit back into the approximates and show that it actually wasn't getting worse and worse because there's a map back to the approximates. Okay, so, and homologically, these region boundaries still bound in the limit three manifold. So there's some chain that they bound, and you can push that chain back into the approximates Okay, it's a nice compact thing because the maps were Lipschitz on the regions. Okay, so this means there's some bi-Lipschitz constant that works. And you get a contradiction. So you get control on the region, and then you can take each region, you've got a nice homeomorphism on each region, and stack them up. So you have a sort of a local homeomorphisms, where local means on each region. And just a degree argument says that you get a homeomorphism that's homotopic to the original thing. And then you have to extend over the Margulis tubes. So the combinatorial numbers, these omega of gammas that we had for each of the simple closed curves, tell you how to extend, although it's not as trivial as you might think, over, once you have a map on the boundary of the tube, over the interior of the tube. And that's the model theorem. In an hour and 4 minutes. Okay, so I won't mention the alternate approach. So there is an alternate approach I was going to say something about that Ken's going to talk about next week, which I think streamlines some of the ideas. It just uses the fact that if you know how to construct a sequence of approximating manifolds to something, that gives you more tools to work with. So somehow we were proving this independent of any kind of notion of approximability by geometrically finite manifolds, just starting with a hyperbolic manifold. If you know that you can approximate things with geometrically finite manifolds, it gives you more hope of controlling for what the limit can look like in terms of the geometrically finite things. So Ken's going to talk about that next week, I guess, but not tomorrow. All right, so that's enough of this. Well, so it's funny. I mean, a lot of it is, yeah, that's a good question. So I think a lot of the geometric meat of the argument comes down to, oddly enough, these kinds of geometric limit arguments, where there's some compactness of maps of pleated surfaces into hyperbolic manifolds, and so the compactness, I mean, I guess it's just, you know, it's just the, you can just think of it as compactness of discrete groups in the, with injectivity radius bounded below at the base frame, at the base point in the Gromov-Hausdorff topology. So something very general. Yeah, right. I mean, which is why none of our constants are ever good. So all of our constants rely on these kinds of assume things are arbitrarily bad and then extract a limit where they aren't bad. Right. So that comes just because you do have a pretty good idea when you're dealing with a single complex translation. You have a better chance of getting a handle on what the geometry of the thin part corresponding to a complex translation with short translation distance in a hyperbolic manifold is for various reasons. So if you know the injectivity radius at the boundary of the tube, you know the complex parameter, then so it's something like knowing that the Teichmuller parameter for the boundary of, so if you remove the endpoints and you take the quotient of C hat minus these 2 points by the action of the group, that's some point in the Teichmuller space of the torus. Right, but I mean, that's just a geometric limit argument at the end of the day. Yeah, but I mean, I sort of, no, okay, so there's a theorem called the uniform injectivity theorem that tells you something about how geodesic, how these surfaces, these pleated surfaces, can sit in a hyperbolic three manifold. And it's something like the fact that it says that it can't just sort of be random. I mean, that you, if you've got a nice incompressible map, say, of a surface into So there's these things called pleated surfaces, okay, which somehow we've been dodging. Okay, so pleated surfaces are like surfaces that are almost like isometric maps of the hyperbolic plane, but they're allowed to bend along one of these geodesic laminations. So they literally have these facets of hyperbolic planar material that are not exactly glued together, but sort of fit together along a lamination. And what uniform injectivity says is that if you've got one of these and it's mapping incompressibly into a hyperbolic 3-manifold, that it somehow can't fold up too much. And this does give you a tremendous amount of control on, I mean, it basically says that if you've got two leaves of the lamination that come close together in the 3-manifold, that they have to also be close together on the surface. So all of these things with combinatorics and curves and everything sort of come from that general idea together with a lot of surgery arguments. So this allows you to do things like control what the bounded curve set looks like and show geometric features of how the set of bounded length curves in the hyperbolic manifold fit in the curve complex. Okay, that's kind of an abstract notion. I mean, but I don't know. It's past time, but I can say two or three more words about maybe a more germane. So let me just give my take on what Ken's going to talk about next week. So what's the point? So essentially, what would you like to be able to say? What you'd like to be able to say is that if you know something about, you have this, let's just say you were willing to believe this much, that the lamination tells you something about what curves are short in the manifold. Is that enough? Well, if you can realize there's this sort of nice theorem about approximation of manifolds by maximal cusps, that anything on the boundary can be approximated by maximal cusps. This is sort of a precursor to some kind of density type thinking. Well, if you've got two points on the boundary and you see these short curves in them, well, if you're lucky and you know some of what Ken developed, you can drill those curves out. You can send them to cusps and see a nice geometric, so you're sort of cutting off the end at some point. So you go out to, say, this tube that you happen to see here, and you poke a hole in it, and you poke a hole in this one. And now you see some geometrically finite manifold that looks like the original manifold out to here. Okay? So you're literally building up it. The limit, the original manifold, not as just some random sequence of approximates, but as a sequence of approximates that look just like the original manifold out to a certain point. It's as if you took the punctured torus case and you took the rational numbers that you get by stopping the continued fraction expansion at the nth entry. So that's a good sequence of approximates to a given irrational. Just stop the continued fraction expansion at some point. So that's kind of what this other proof is meant to do. We actually build a nice sequence of approximants that you can really see is resembling the original manifold. Okay? Well, if you know that the curves in question are similar, you can do that for, say, M, and you can also do it for M prime. So you've got some sequence of short curves in each of these two manifolds, poke them out, and now you can say, well, these geometrically finite approximates look the same because they just look like the original manifold out to some stage. So that means their limit has to be the same. You've got a sequence of approximates that are by Lipschitz, uniformly by Lipschitz, of two different manifolds a priori, then those manifolds actually have to be the same in the limit because you're going to take a limiting quasi-conformal conjugacy of them, or a limiting by Lipschitz conjugacy. So there the geometric work is in knowing that you can actually do this, that you can actually drill out these short curves. I'm not sure that